Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles.
All right, so we are now going to continue. We're reading Psalm 34. We're still finishing up the second part, part two of the three parts. And tonight we will finish the entire psalm. So we're now dealing with this famous line that we know well, you know, Mihaish, Echafetz Chaim, et cetera, et cetera. And now we're going to read Sur Meira Ba'asei Tov, Ba'kesh Shalom, Berodfehu. Turn from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Okay, so you should know, I know you've been all waiting for this little tidbit of information, that the first part of this clause, Sur Meira Ba'asei Tov, is actually repeated in Psalm 37, in verse 27. How about that? Now, that is a little bit of trivia. That's a small bit of trivia. So if somebody asks you, where does Sur Meira Ba'asei Tov, turn away from evil and do good, where is that found a second time? Now you know. 37:27, okay? Does that
put... That would make me think that those two psalms were written by the same person.
Very, very likely. Yeah, that's very possible. Very, very possible. Yes.
Or one copied off the other one.
It's true, too. You know, but I didn't do an analysis of 37, but you'll find blocks of psalms that are very similar. I mean, there's no question about it. Well, I'll talk about this, what I'm going to say next time. All right. Anyway, moving forward. All right. So now, you're right, though. I mean, Barbara, because I did glance through Psalm 37. I'm reminded now. And there are motifs there that are similar to Psalm 34. So yeah, that's a good observation. Ah, you see, you're becoming an expert reader of Psalms. Very good. All right, now this expands the horizon. Okay. So now what we have to note here is that in each of the clauses, there are two different acts. All right, let's look at that. You're right, you got two clauses. Yes. Okay, 1 second. Come on. All right. Sur Meira Ba'asei Tov, right? Ba'kesh Shalom V'rodfehu. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. So you have Sur, Asei, Ba'kesh, Radaf. Four different verbs. Okay? And again, this fits in with the notion that the psalm conveys, especially heavily, in the second part, which is that the seeking of this, the action, you just can't wait for God. Remember, God is not a major player in the second component. God's a major player in the first and the third, but the focus in the second one is that the human has to take responsibility and seek all these positive things and avoid the bad stuff, okay? And that clearly is a message in this particular verse, okay? The interesting thing is, Sur Meira Ba'asei Tov, this contrast of how you deal with evil and good, it's sort of for me, what popped into my head was the rabbinic definition of the two kinds of mitzvot, okay? There are all kinds of, you know, there are two different categories of two different kinds of mitzvot. There's the mitzvot between human and human, and the mitzvot between human and God. That's one category. But there's another one. Positive commandments.
Negative.
And negative commandments, what you shouldn't do. So this one actually, Sur Meira, avoid evil, that would be what you don't do. That's a negative commandment. Asei Tov, do good, is a positive command. So, you know, these notions that we often ascribe to the rabbis, you can see the roots of them. And then, you know, many of the sages knew their Bible very well. And so these themes, these ideas are, you know, floating around in their heads. And so when they express them in their own way, it's not surprising to see precedents in the Bible. And these connections should be made. You see the foundations of the rabbinic thinking, because we often think, and rightfully so, that the rabbis are very creative when it comes to their understanding of the Bible. Yeah, but still, even having said that, still the use of biblical paradigms in rabbinic thinking is writ large. Okay, Bert.
I'm struck by the word rotfehu.
Yes.
It's not just going, it's kind of like a rotef. I mean, it's like coming after it.
Yes.
Actively, isn't it a very active verb?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. That's exactly the point. Mm-hmm. Really, not just seek it. You know, it's even stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You run after it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes, exactly. And that's the point.
You don't wait for it to come to you either. No.
Well, that's the point of the whole psalm.
Right.
Right. Ultimately, that's the point of the entire, all three sections have that, the whole notion you got to do. You know, it's like the line in I think I said this before, in the Top Gun Maverick. Don't think, just do. Right. And then good thinking. Well, you got to think sometime. All right. Okay, so that's that. Now, it's interesting because it says, seek peace, right? Now, that is a very, and maybe that's why it says, Sur Me Rabba Seytov, Ose Shalom Avrothehu, right? Seek peace and pursue it, yeah? Do good and pursue it. To do good in a chaotic world takes a lot of effort, right? To overcome the forces of evil, it's not easy. And I think, Bert, the notion that he chooses Rodfehu means you got to work hard. You got to really run and do with great energy in order to keep evil under control.
And isn't shalom a lot broader than just lack of war and chaos?
Yes, yes. Well,
there's a completeness to it and unity and all that.
Exactly. Yes, it's a multifaceted word. There's no question about it. You see that in a minute. In fact, yeah, in this particular case, I think it can be understood as chaos. No, the antithesis to chaos, order, right? As you said, shalom, wholeness. So there's a number of nuances to the word, absolutely. Yes. Okay, Tybel.
So part of what I've gotten, I don't remember which class, is a whole new set of thoughts about the root tom, which I had no idea before learning with you. All I knew was the simple son, really. So my question for you, which is a more nuanced root, shalem or tom?
What's the say? Tom?
Yeah, where I thought, I mean, oh, what? Mean,
like the tom, I understand what you mean. Yes, it is. Tamim, tom, tafmem, yes?
Yes, but which one is more nuanced?
They're both nuanced. Tom can mean complete. It can mean simple. Okay. There are nuances. Correct. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, remember, I'm telling you all along, you look in the lexicons, Hebrew, the words in Hebrew have multiple meanings. And therefore, you've got to figure out from the context which of the meaning is the most meaningful. But the context is very important in this regard. Okay. So,
Joel, excuse me. What is good, really? I mean, is it
Tov?
When I see, Is it when I'm nice to them and take care of good care? Or is it when I do free social work for seeing patients for free? I mean, is it going out to the community and helping somebody? What is good in this kind?
Well, I think everything you said.
Oh.
I mean, seriously, it's the same thing with Tove. Okay. I want to refer you to something right now that it'll sort of make you. Somebody's talking. Okay. Thank you. So this notion, this contrast between, you know, good and evil, shalom, ra, brings to mind something you're familiar with, right? What's the first blessing after the Baruch Hu in the morning?
Yotzer or v'recho shech, osesh shel v'recho, no?
Right. Osesh, exactly. Yotzer or v'recho shech, osesh shalom, v'vore'et hakol. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you have, however.
That's not what it really was.
No.
Right.
The original, you guys are reading my brain here. Shut up. How dare you read my anyway. Because Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7 says, Yotzer or uvorei choshech, oseh shalom, uvorei ra. Evil. Okay, so many people look at that and say, well, shalom would be harmony, and ra would be chaos, that's fine.
I go back to the beginning of Bereishit and the word Tov.
Yes.
Which is the word God repeatedly uses for the creation.
Yes, exactly, yes.
It almost has a capital T. I know there's
that's the whole point. Clearly, it's not a moral principle.
Right.
Goodness. It means harmonious. It's working. You know, all the parts are working together.
And that's why in Sefaria, shalom is translated as amity.
Yeah.
Oh, that amity, that's JPS, I think.
And yeah,
Mr. that is JPS.
Talks about that it's amity between people, ben adam le adam.
Yeah, exactly, right. Benji uses the word peace because I think he was seeking a more global term here. Because this is not really, doesn't say anything about Jews.
No.
Right? So it's more universal, really. I think that may be why he chose that. yeah, so I mean, that line from Isaiah just popped into my head. But the point there, of course, is that God is being the big guy. He's standing up and saying, I created Tov, or, you know, Shalom, but I also created Ra. Because the whole point here is he's saying there's only, if there's only one of me, and which is the case, then any phenomenon that exists in the universe has to be put on my on my desk. The buck stops here. Otherwise, if there are other forces at work, then I'm not me. But I am me. There's only one of me, a universal me, and that's it. So it's an amazing statement for a God to make, you know, and he admits I'm responsible for the chaos in the world. And indeed, the interesting thing is, if you look at Genesis chapter 1 in this wonderful world, it doesn't say that the chaos is gone. Nowhere does it say that, right? He controls things. He separates things. He creates order, right? And the fact is, later on, you'll find the word a tohu. I mean, it's used the poem at the end of Devarim, right? Moses' song.
Ha'azinu?
Huh?
Ha'azinu?
Yes, Ha'azinu, right? It's Eretz Tohu v'Yishimon. He said the Midbar, land of tohu, chaos, right? And moaning. Yishimon apparently is a sound. like the wind blows. Ooh, you know, I mean, it's true. I've been in the Sinai, and you hear these things. It's not an exaggeration. And is the Sinai, can it be called Tohu? Some places it really can be. And if a wind blows, of course, it's even worse. So, I mean, it's, so God is basically accepting responsibility for all of that. Yeah, he's a big guy, you know, he's good. But what this is saying is, granted that God's assuming responsibility, but who has to participate in the process of this psalm is saying that we, as human beings, have got to create shalom and tov. It's interesting, right? We have to create the harmony and the kind of ideal situation that God recognized when he finished creating. It's interesting. You think about that. And so we're participants in this. And that's the whole point. That's the whole point. Okay. All right. So God is not the big actor in this part. But now we're going to turn to the third part. And once again, we're going to see those verbs of saving and redeem, you know, various forms of saving are going to be expressed. And God is going to, again, resume God's role as a major player, while at the same time, it's assumed that human beings are going to play their part as well. Okay. Now, the first thing to tell you is this, according to Torat Rembaum, okay, it doesn't mean that it's what I'm about to tell you is everybody's going to agree upon this, but I believe that this part is actually an absolute chiasm. Again, one of those A, B, B, A type things, except here we have an X. There's a middle thing. All right? So now I'll just review this, and it's this. If part two was structured, remember four times Tov, every other verse. We talked about this last time. Tov,
yes.
Tov, Tov, beginning and ending with Tov, and in the middle Tov and Tov, and always with a line without Tov. It's Tov, no Tov, Tov, no reference to the whole thing. Okay, all seven verses. Now we got a structure here as well that is highly structured and also in the form of a chiasm. So just looking at words, in verse 16, we have the reference to a tzaddik, the tzaddikim. That happens again in verse 20, but it also happens in verse 22. Okay? So you have, that's the A, the tzaddik in verse 16, and the tzaddik in 22. All right, the second, you have Hitzil, saved, in verse 18, and Yatzilenu, same root, save, in verse 20. So that's the B, and the X in the middle is Yoshia. Okay, we'll redeem, we'll make free, we'll. It's a stronger form of saving, a more personal. We'll talk about that. So it's like this concept of Yoshia is the center point here, and Lahatzil is sort of a setback in terms of its shall we say power, and it's very interesting because you know we talk about Hashem Hoshia Hamelach Yanino. That's really an epitome of God's activity, right? That's how God saves. And it's stronger than Hitzil. So that I'm suggesting that particular line is sort of a peak in terms of that concept of God's saving power. But again, you have one verse that separates A, the tzaddik from Hitzil, verse 17. And you have one verse, verse 21, that separates between the Yatzilenu and tzaddik at the end. Okay? And then Hitzil is 18, Yoshia is 19, Yatzilenu is 20. So the three verbs that deal with God saving are one right there. That's the center. The center of the center is Yoshia. But the center part of the whole section are those three verbs of redeeming and saving. So I didn't make it up. I mean, it's there. Okay? Now there's other nuances flowing through it independent of the chiasm, for sure. But the wording, the way it's set up, I think is conveying a message, which is the God's saving power. Okay? And we've got to participate with that. Whereas in the second part, right, God's goodness was the basic theme. Okay? All right. Tybel.
The way you were saying that, I was reminded of the four, possibly five verbs in the Haggadah that became the symbols for the blessings in the wine.
Yes.
The Haggadah, of course, is much later than the Psalms, but...
No, that's from the Exodus.
No, the interpretation.
No, it's not. It's Leviticus 25.
But I thought the interpretation is much later because it's a goddess. So what I was going to ask, because it reminded me, are verbs more important somehow in Psalms than other parts of speech?
No, I don't think so. Not necessarily. Every part of speech has meaning to them. Okay, the use of tzaddik here clearly is important. Okay, there's another term that's going to be here, ra, right? And that's a powerful word here, and it was a powerful word, and tov was a powerful word in the second part, right? So those are not verbs. So I mean, I think verbs are always important because they're action words and they deal with action, and that's an important, I'm not trying to diminish their importance, but I don't think it's the only thing that the psalmists focus on. But that would require a word-by-word analysis of 150 psalms. And I'm sorry to say, I'm not going to do that. If someone wants to volunteer to go through the entire book of Psalms and you know, chart the significance of verbs, nouns, adjectives, adverbs, prepositions, etc. Okay, I bless you. No, it's not. By the way, I'm trying to. It's Deuteronomy 25. I mean, it. Hold on. All right, go ahead, Bert. I got to check up.
I'm struck by the view from 10,000 feet here.
What?
The view from 10,000 feet, not down into the words and the grammar. But if the middle part is saying you're supposed to do good and seek peace, this part to me says, because if you do, God will protect you.
Well, it's the same thing as in the first part.
Yeah, and that even though the righteous may suffer, which I think is interesting because God doesn't promise that the righteous won't suffer, that ultimately God will protect you and defeat your enemies. And so to me, this is the answer to, well, why would we do that stuff in the middle part? And that is for God's protection.
Wait, please repeat. I'm sorry.
I was going to say part of what this third section answers for me, or I think is an explanation of, is if you do all that other stuff, if you do tov and you look away from ra, then God will protect you. And that even if you're righteous and have a lot of troubles, even then, God will protect you. Yeah. So to me, this is a very comforting, if you want, ending or a compliment to the section before it. Right. Kind of from a view from 10,000 feet and not in
that. But in a moment, you're going to see there's a line in here that actually pushes in the opposite direction.
Uh-oh.
I mean, you're right. You're right. I think you're right. Because you'll see. I'm not going to say what it is now. But it's something we're going to talk about, because it's a very troubling statement. Okay, very troubling statement. Give me 1 minute, please. I got to find this.
I think I found it, Rabbi. I think it's Shmos. I put it in the chat.
Where?
I think it's Shmos, chapter 6, verses 6 and 7.
No. Oh, Hotzeti Hitzalti. Oh, yes. I think you're right. I was thinking of something else. You're absolutely right. Thank you. What I was thinking of is the section Arami Oved Avi. That's the one that's, I think, Deuteronomy 25. That's what you say when you bring your first fruits. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, my father was a wandering Aramaean.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yes, that is correct. Thank you, Tybel. Very good. All right. So now, here's some interesting things. God is active in each verse from 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21. God is active. Now he sees, hears, erases memorials, saves three times, and guards. So this is totally the antithesis of the second part. Okay. Also, something else we got to keep in mind. Verses 16 and 17. Look at verses 16 and 17 for a minute, which we're going to read right now. They are what's called a dyad, D-Y-A-D, two elements that combine into one. All right. In other words, it's two verses really that could be one verse, but the tradition separated it. Okay. And we'll see why that's important in a minute. And you see that the eyes and the ears are doing one thing and the face is doing something else. And they are intended to be a contrast. So the question is, we have to look carefully at the Hebrew, which we will, to see where the difference in thrust here is. It's very subtle. But again, I think it has to do with the genius of the author. Okay. Let's look at those verses. All right. So this is verse 16. Enei Adonai el tzadikim ve'oznav el, excuse me, shavatam. God's eyes are toward the righteous and his ears toward their wailing.
They're wailing?
Wailing, yeah. Yes, Shabbatam. So in other words, it means God is directing divine energy clearly in a way, and we'll see this now in verse 18, okay? In verse 18, we're going to come back to the tzadikim and see what the result is, okay? But the point is, he's toward them. It's a drawing close, if you will, and we're going to see later on that the word karov with respect to God is here, later when one of the in verse 19. All right? Okay. So that's the thrust of verse 16. But now the panim, the face in verse 17. Pnei Adonai be'osei ra, God's face is set against the evildoers. La'achrit me'aretz zichram, to cut off their memory from the earth. Okay? Now.
What does it mean, set against?
Enmity. They're God's enemies. So God is responding to them. That's the whole point. The L of verse 16, right, is a drawing close. The bet, the B, God's face is B, right? It's with, it's confronting. It's not close. It may be close, but it's close for destructive purposes, if you will. Okay, so it's a difference. That's the subtlety here in how this is expressed. And he wants to cut off their memory from the land, from the earth. So they won't even be, they're totally gone. Now, Leon, you have a hand up?
No, you explained it, the bit. I didn't see the naked.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Now, Rick.
Yes, hi, Rabbi. We just had Panim El Panim in the Torah portion last week. So Moses and God were face to face. I'm just supporting you. El is a good thing. Panim Be is something else.
Exactly. Right. That's right. Yeah. It's almost the El implies sort of a relationship, whereas the Be is more pragmatic. I'm going to do something to you, not for you. And that's what's to cut off the memory of these people. Now, where else do you find in the Torah? I'm thinking of two instances.
Amalek.
Amalek. Good. First, that's exactly right. I will wipe off their memory, right? I will wipe them from their memory. They're from the earth.
And we're supposed to remember to forget them.
That's right. That's a very interesting point. don't forget. Don't forget. You got to wipe their memory off the earth. I love that. Yes, it's an oxymoron. I don't know. All right. But there's another. Who else said, it was a little bit different. He said, wipe my name from the book, which essentially is the same message. Erase my name from the book. All right. 2 seconds. 1 second. Time's up. Moses, when he's arguing with God after the golden calf, he says, if you destroy the people, then wipe my name from the book, so to speak. I don't even want to be associated in your book of good people. Right. It's like he's saying, I don't want to be associated with you. It's a threat. You know, and God says, whoops, okay, I heard you. It's part of his argument. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Is it clear from the Hebrew that this is people who are evil? It says Ra, doesn't it?
Osei Ra.
Well, that's clearly people.
Of course.
Okay.
I mean, who else does evil? I mean, yeah, you could say, animals do evil.
Okay, but it's clearly people. I mean,
people, of course it is. I mean, it's a contrast against the tzaddikim, right? It's the antithesis of the tzaddik. Tzaddik is people, so this is people, the evildoers, right? Okay, but now we're going to go back to the tzaddik. Tzaku v'adonai shama umikol tzarotam hitzilam. Right, it ended that his ear, God's ear in verse 16, is to their moaning, right? And so 18 says, I heard, right? They shouted out, and I heard, says God in 18, and I saved them from all of their troubles, right? He heard and he saved, or saves. Okay? So, that is a, so that's, so the, there you now find the, and this goes back to the tzaddikim of verse 16. So 17, right, is out of sequence, if you will. 16 and 18 pick up and join together as the expression of what God does for the righteous. Okay? And now the 19 again is speaking doesn't really speak about the righteous. Okay. But it's also God's redeeming, delivering. This is interesting. Here you find he delivers. This is Yoshia. We're right in the now working into the middle of the X, the midpoint of the structure. Karo Adonai l'nishbarei lev. God is close to the brokenhearted. Literally, nishbarei lev is brokenhearted. Okay? Vet Dak'e Ruach Yoshia, and he will deliver those who are crushed in spirit. Okay? Now, that is a more general statement, to be sure. And it's important because it's reminding us that it's not just the tzaddik about whom God is concerned, all right? But this is but you can say, among the nishbarei lev and those whose spirits, you know, who's brokenhearted and whose spirit is crushed, is it possible that there are tzaddikim within that group? Question. Don't know. Marlies.
Yes. Thank you, Rabbi. I was just wondering, when you're talking about those who do evil and then tzaddikim, about the whole relationship of tshuva, and if that concept was later than these psalms were written, because it seems to me that some of the, you know, some of the same people could be considered one or the other depending on what they're doing, you know.
Yeah. No, I understand. And that was, it's sort of like you wanted to say, maybe God could be listening to the evil ones in verse 18, except the verse 17 is so categorical, right? It's so categorical. God does not, in this psalm, God has not made, the concept of repentance is not a central concept. No, it's around. There's no question. Yeah, it's the concept is already in existence, I'm sure. Well, that's a good question, though. Hold on. Because if you think about, depending on, it's hard to peg the timing of this verse because it's so, I don't know, there's not a lot of Hebrew here that is ancient. And some of these terms like Nishbarei Lev and Dak'e Ruach are very poetic, very sophisticated. And I don't know that that's something that the earlier forms of Hebrew would have used. I mean, it's really beautiful language. So it may be that it's around. It's not on the agenda here, because he's not talking about what you need to do to repair relationships. The whole thing is to do what you need to do. It basically, what it's saying is, you've got to turn to God and do basically the things that God would like you to do in order to get this house in order and in order to deal with the oppression that you feel. And the whole point is, the common denominator with all three parts is that there are people suffering. And that's, he's saying, God will help, right? And that this is even more powerful than the first one, right? Because God is doing a lot here. He's doing a lot, right?
The whole concept of karov,
right,
which is the opposite of God up in heaven in some completely other place. Yeah, that's in 140, Psalm 145 as well.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Karov and El Hol Karov, exactly. To those who call upon him. So that's more in line with the first,
the truth.
The first third.
Yeah.
Call upon him, right? But that's going to come up later. Okay, I think that's 1 second. Let me just check. No, it's not. No. God is really, this is sort of the high point of God's compassionate action, his saving action. And the point is, it's tzaddik. Remember, we said in the first part that the Yirei Hashem, right, the people who are God-fearers and the people who turn to God, those are the ones that action on their part will generate a response to God. And we said that the mere fact that somebody is defined as a God-fearer assumes that they're going to turn to God. I think it's the same thing here with the tzaddik. Okay, the tzaddik is mentioned three times, as I said. And it may be that the tzaddik are those who are brokenhearted. But the point is that these are people who, by their very nature, are turning to God. That's part of their righteousness. And so it's assumed that turn to God is present. just by saying tzaddik. Okay, it's a person who totally wraps their consciousness about God and God's presence. Okay, yes, Leon.
I think that there is something else going on here, because on 19, Karov Adonai Lev Nishperei Lev, he's saying something that is completely sideways to what he said before. Yes, he answers the call of those who are tzaddikim, but here he simply says, but I have an affinity to Nishperei Lev ve'et tekae ruach Yoshia.
Yeah.
He seems to be stating something else, that he's got a certain affinity to them, whether they're tzaddikim or not.
Yes. No, you're right. But it's sort of begging a question, which we'll get to in a minute. Keep this in mind. Okay? Keep this in mind. Okay?
Joel?
Yes.
I've never studied Psalms before this session, which is making it really fascinating for me. And with a statement you just made a few minutes ago, is there a general rule or logic with all Psalms in that they're saving us that God is saving us? Or is every Psalm completely independent and no connection from one to the other?
Well, I would say, there are psalms, there are blocks of psalms that are similar. They have shared language, shared perspectives, and they're different from others. There are some psalms that go off. In fact, we may read, if we decide, we have to a decision to make tonight, folks. But I mean, there's another psalm I want to look at that moves us into a different realm of psalm writing, okay? And there's one line in here coming up that would be sort of, they would use and make a big deal about it where it's not made a big deal about here. So for example, if you read Psalms, which these are not Psalms we're gonna look at, but we're in the same block though. Psalms 42, 43, and 44, you will see their anger and frustration with respect to God. And Psalm 44 in particular, it reaches a high point where this guy is basically saying, where the hell are you? And there's no clear statement of their faith in God. Okay? They say, the guy says, if I did something wrong, if we sinned, let me know. Talk to me. If you need to admonish me, fine. But your dead silence, and I'm down here suffering, and others are suffering too, and we don't deserve it. That's what he's saying. And it doesn't, there's no out here. I mean, here there'll be an out at the end, a statement. And the whole thing here is a statement that God's doing in behalf of people. There it's totally called into question. Okay? That's really something, isn't it? And you find that whole section has that tone to it. Now, that happens to be, it's very interesting, that's B'nai Korach. There's a small segment of the Psalms that are ascribed to the so-called sons of Korach, which is ironic, because Korach, of course, in the Torah is one of the bad guys, almost the worst of the worst, because he's from Moshe's Mishpucha, and he revolts against Moshe and Aaron. Okay. Anyway, so the answer to your question, Barbara, is there are different thrusts. I would say the overall impact of the Psalms is a praising of God. But look, Psalm 22, which is not of the Korachites, begins, Eli, Eli. We read it. It's Lama Zeftani, why did you abandon me? Right, that first line right there is really radical. And there it is. So, I mean, it's in a sense, it's the same as what you find in elements of Ecclesiastes, right? Of Kohelet. So those streams exist in even other books altogether. Yeah, so it's a good question, though. I would say there are multiple themes that flow through Psalms. Yeah. All right, Bert.
Just briefly, I was trying to sort out what tzaddikim means within the context of this psalm. In other words, the kind of behavior that's being promoted here, that God rewards. And it seems to me, at least from what I see here, it has to do with speech and how we treat each other. It's not kind of a ritual that God is looking for here. It's don't guard your tongue. Don't speak evil.
Those are not tzaddikim there. Remember that. Part two doesn't mention tzaddik, does it?
So the tzaddikim that this is talking about.
It might have them in mind, but here it's clearly stated.
Okay.
And there's a reason for that, because they're in a separate category. And that's the whole point. They're in that category.
But the tzaddikim is based on how they treat other people or how they treat God or both?
I would say both.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they treat other people in a certain way because their commitment to God is so strong.
Okay.
That's what that should be, because God is supposed to be the tzaddik of tzaddikim, the righteous one,
okay.
Right? The ultimate righteous one. And so this is imitation of God.
The other thing, just quickly, I was reading an essay by Lord Jonathan Sacks, and he mentioned that the only psalm that says that says praise at the beginning, Tehillah, is 145, and yet these are all called Tehillim.
Oh.
The other ones are Mizmor.
That's interesting, yeah.
There's no other psalm where it's...
Right. That's interesting. That's
it's Tehillah David, and yet these are... I'm not sure I understand what that means, but I thought it was interesting.
Right. Well, but remember, but the whole line of psalms there ends with hallelujah.
Right.
Right? The last six psalms, right. 145 to 150, that is Psukei Dezimra.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather it's interesting. They're not called Psukei Tehillah. They're called Psukei Dezimra.
Zimra.
Of songs, right. So, yeah, I mean, but maybe it may be that it's mentioned there because it is the first of that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that the intention of the whoever it was put them together was to use that first line, Tehillah LeDavid. And then the other ones all follow, right? So, but it's an interesting observation, yeah. Okay, all right, so.
Heibel had something to say.
Yeah, I know. I'm
going. Oh, okay.
Yes, thank you very much. Okay, Tybel.
When you were talking about the block and anger, I just kept thinking about how Rachel Goldberg, the mother of the very articulate mother of the hostage, is now starting over. People probably know that she was, in addition to keeping the number taped on her clothing of what day she was reading the psalm for that day, and now that it's past 150, she's starting over. And I just...
Yeah.
And sometimes she had meditations on a particular psalm in relation to her son being captive.
Yes. No, but I mean, the fact is, that reading psalms for people with a certain level of piety is a means of maintaining one's faith in the face of some great tragedy.
All right. Well, that's why Shomrim do it when they're guarding remains.
Right. Well, that's part, I would say, the Shomer doing that. It's also part of the Ilui Nefesh, of the process of helping the soul to be elevated into the realm of the divine, okay? That which is something, when you say Kaddish, according to the tradition, that's what you're doing. You're elevating the soul up, and it implies that, it's not clear because there's no dogma in Judaism of what the life after death is. But the understanding is that nobody's perfect. Everybody needs all the help they can get if they want to really find their place in heaven. And so that's what we're going to do. And even though people make repentance, and by the way, the whole concept of tshuva comes into play. If the whole vidui that you say when a person's on their deathbed, whether the person says it themselves or you do it for them because they can't talk, the whole idea is that it's supposed to be a confessional, and it's a process of cleansing. But apparently, you know, nobody knows for sure how that all works. And so any effort we can make to enhance that and to ensure that the pathway to being God's presence is clear and direct as possible is by getting us to participate in that process. But it also, I mean, you've heard me say this before. For me, when I said Kaddish for my folks, especially my father who died relatively quickly, my mom was a more prolonged situation. But, you know, I couldn't stop the process. Well, this was in both cases. Once the death process had begun, there was nothing I could do to stop it. I was powerless, okay? And that's a fact, you are. So the whole point was, what can I do? Okay, once they go, I'll say Kaddish. I'll send up a spiritual gift to them, okay? Is that a rational statement? No, it's faith, right? I can't prove it. I can't put that down mathematically, right? I can't show you a formula to express that, but it's faith, and I found it comforting. I'm pretty much a rationalist, as you probably know by now. But there is this faith side of me, and it needs tending from time to time. So saying Kaddish for me was a very important thing, you know. Okay, now, so it's possible that even these brokenhearted people are among them, are tzaddikim, which deals with, which opens the door to some very powerful questions. But before we get there, again, as I said before, this notion of Yoshia, of delivering people, right? It's a more conclusive kind of statement than simply help, the saving. When you deliver someone, you're really it's a completed process. Saving could be loose ends. Delivering is a sign. I think that's why it's in the middle. It's a more powerful form of saving than just to lahatzil. And that's why it's there. Okay, but now the verse, the first part of which, three words. But look at verse 20. We'll read the whole thing. Rabot ra'ot tzadik umikulam yatzilenu Adonai. Okay. Look at Benji, so you don't have it. Well, no, I don't. Yeah, all right. Though the misfortunes of the righteous be many. I like Benji's better. Many are the evils befalling the righteous. Talks about ra'ot. Okay. The evils that be many are the evils that befall the righteous. What in heck does that mean?
Well, doesn't that mean that nothing is perfect in this world? That as much as we want everything to be exactly what we want it to be, then sometimes things go the other way. Sometimes they're not what we want.
Right. Oh, this says rabot, many.
Well, it happens a lot of times. I mean, there's never just one time.
No, I understand. Why the emphasis? But it's making a kind of a categorical statement. An evil person suffers righteous, suffers many, I'll start that again. Sorry.
Righteous person.
I got my descriptives mixed up. A righteous person suffers much evil.
I think that's true. I mean,
why?
We don't get, because we just don't get everything in life that we want. I think life is meant to be a little bit tough at times.
It is. I'll grant you that. But that's not, you're missing the point, I think. It's as if this person is, because of their righteousness, is suffering. That's what's saying.
I don't think it's because of it. I mean, it's because of it.
It doesn't say rabot ra'ot libnei adam, right? It doesn't say, or yirei Hashem. It doesn't say the God-fearers suffer great evil. It doesn't say that the average Joe, who's a good person, suffers great evil. It specifically says that the righteous does. And that seems to be a kind of contradiction in terms. Or at least that there's some imbalance here. If a person is righteous, and it says God will protect them. Yeah, God will, it says God will save them in the end. So it could be that the brokenhearted includes that's a righteous, as you got a brokenhearted righteous person. Okay, but let's leave that aside. Why is it hard on a righteous person? I mean, I'm not denying what you're saying, Barbara. Yes, the world is imperfect.
And that's, you're implying that
that's the global. That's the global issue. Granted.
So you're implying that the righteous suffer more evil? I don't believe that.
Well, it doesn't say rabot to anybody else of the suffering. Go through the psalm. It's only the right. That word is used only with the righteous. Okay. Wait, Rick, did you have your hand up?
Well, I was going to ask about the ra'ot here. We just dealt with osei ra up above, and there it was more like chaos. So
no, that was the ra. No, that was just drawing an attention, your attention to the use of it in Isaiah. It has many
right.
more. I think here.
Yeah. And we have nitzor lashon chame ra.
Right.
So they're talking. The author is talking about ra in different situations, and here it's too bad there's only three words. It's you have to fill in all the little words in between, but
right.
Exactly. Rabot ra'ot could be just a lot of chaos, couldn't it? Does it have to be a lot of evil?
But generally, if you're going to see later on, look at verse 22. The evil there, ra'ah, is the subject, because it's feminine. Tvotate is a feminine verb. So evil, ra'ah, which is the same ra'ot as here, because it's also feminine, right?
Yeah.
Evil shall slay the wicked. And we'll get to that, what it means. But that's the ra'ah. Now you could say chaos. I think here it's talking about acts of evil, because chaos can be an earthquake. What we're talking about here, I think we mentioned it before, is more interpersonal stuff. And that's the point that that Bert was trying to make. This is more focused among people, and I think it's correct.
So in back to 20, it's in between people affecting the righteousness, the righteous ones?
Yeah,
it's not the right. 21. The righteous ones don't do chaotic acts. It's other people doing it to them or the situation.
Right. And that's the 22. Those are the actors in number 22.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. Who else? Leon?
I think Ibn Ezra's got it right. He says, Im tiru tzadik shebau alav ra'ot al yu'ash. Yes. Ki Hashem yatzileinu mikulam. So that a person who is a righteous person should not despair if there are a lot of evils coming upon him, because he shall be saved.
Right.
But it also reminds me of the Talmud, which we're talking about. I think it's in Berachot that says Tzadik ben Tzadik veralo.
Yeah, of course, that's the same thing. Right.
Yeah.
Tzaddik is a person that gets bad, right? And the bad person is okay, you know, that type of a thinking. Yeah, same thing. So, but why? Think about a righteous person. Why would that person be a magnet for suffering of evil? Why would somebody even make that kind of an association? Any thoughts? Wait, Bert. Bert, your lips are moving, but I cannot hear you.
Doesn't this get to the question of why do bad things sometimes happen to good people? I mean, is it not dealing with this that whole issue?
Yes.
You don't have an answer to, as it says in Pirkei Avot.
No, but the point is, again, that is correct. But this is sort of an extreme statement. And then dafka, but tzaddik. That's the point.
Yes, and even though this may happen, nevertheless, God.
That's okay. I understand that too. But I'm still not, you still didn't answer me. Why is it an assumption that evil, that righteous people are going to suffer? Okay, so first, when I have Marlies, did you raise your hand?
And yeah. Then, oh.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just thinking that maybe as part of their righteousness, they're getting involved in more things in the world, and there's just more opportunity for things to happen to them.
That's a very interesting point.
And trying to do good, you know, they
right
maybe are going against people who are, you know, doing things that aren't so good.
No, I think you're moving in a very interesting direction. Well, I'm glad I called on you. That's good. Okay, Tybel.
Immediately I thought of Nachshon Ben Aminadav. Because if you're the first one there, you're going to encounter the difficulty first, where if, I don't know, 50, 100, whatever people are joining you in doing something, the odds of encountering whatever it is, and I think Nachshon becomes a good example because that wasn't another human, that right. was a force of nature.
Yes. In other words, so the first responder deals with the biggest part of the crisis. Hmm. So it's not identical to what Marlies said, but I think they sort of go together. And I think you're moving, my feeling and my judgment on this is you're moving in the right direction. Wait, Leon, did you have your hand? I don't recall.
Yes, I did, but I think it was answered perfectly well so far.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think there's something else too. Those are two very, very perceptive responses. I gave a drash about this once. And my thought was, righteous people can be very upsetting to others, okay? And can evoke heartbreak on the righteous person because they want to make change. As you said, Marlies, and as you said, Tybel, okay, they're the ones who want to bring righteousness into the world where there's unrighteousness. And sometimes it can even be that it's ironic, a righteous person can sometimes be a very obnoxious person and make people feel uncomfortable. And so they respond to that person, you know, oh, that's all you keep saying all the time. All I hear from you is global warming, that we got to change. Come on, leave me alone. Enough already. Where that righteous person says, I'm sorry, we are responsible for it. We got to fix it. But the other person says, I can't do that myself, so shut up. You know, the righteous person is, you know, plunks ahead, but it hurts. That's just one example. And now, especially this righteous person, this is the person, for example, when they see someone begging on the street, they'll provide, give them something. It may not be money, right? Maybe they'll give them a sandwich or a, you know, one of these bars with a protein bar. Something that they can eat, make it, you know, deal with their hunger, give them some energy, something good, okay? And that person, remember, that person did that, and you walk by and see them doing that. How does it make you feel about yourself? Maybe a little guilty? Gee, why did he think of that? Why didn't I? Will I really go ahead and do this? It's a nice thing that guy did. But I didn't do that. I'll try now. Maybe I'll go ahead. He set a good example, that righteous guy. I'll follow it. Or I'm too busy. And then you begin to feel guilty. He did it and I didn't. And then, you know, this guy fills you with guilt. It's complicated. But doing, you know, being a righteous person and your righteousness, your definition of righteousness may really fly in the face of people who see everything in black and white. And you, as a righteous person, understand that things are complicated. And you got to keep plugging away and just try to uncomplicate stuff. Anyway, it's a complicated situation to be a righteous person. Barbara.
I don't know if this girl was righteous, but I remember in college when I was at Cal in Berkeley, and we would walk to school because the boarding house was a distance away from school, as were the everything was housing one. And when we'd walk, she'd say, "Oh, it's such a beautiful day, and it could be raining, or it could be bright and sunny, or the trees had already shed their leaves." What was pretty about the trees to me, but to her, everything was beautiful. It was amazing. And I used to wonder, how can anybody go through life thinking everything is beautiful? Because there are things that are not beautiful all the time.
Yeah.
Things, life is not perfect.
Right. But on the other hand, a righteous person is a person who should be appreciating what is beautiful and trying to fix the things that are not. But you're motivated.
Fix rain.
No, but the point is, though, that you're motivated. If you think everything is bad, then you're not going to do anything.
Oh, but, no, I never thought everything was bad.
I'm trying to get into the head of a righteous person.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
right,
a righteous person would be one who would say 100 blessings a day, to use the classic example, right? When they see a beautiful tree, when they see, you know, have good fruit, when they see a good person or bright, you know, a very intelligent person, okay, all right, when they see beautiful trees, so they appreciate it. And then they realize that there are places where those beautiful trees are being chopped down, perhaps without any thought to what's being chopped down. I'm thinking, for example, Brazil, what they've done decimated to the rainforests there, and the impact that that has not only on that country, but in the world.
In the world.
Yeah. Okay. And those are beautiful trees. I mean, you know, yes, I talk a lot about the redwoods that we saw, but I mean, when we saw those big trees, they're just overwhelmingly unbelievable. And it's to think that when you go look at those forests, it's only 10% of what was prior to 1800. They were huge forests of those trees. And they're miracles. But people only saw the lumber. They only saw the opportunity to make furniture. You know, it's fine. You can build things with trees. But we've learned today to somehow not totally manage that. But, you know, we plant forests that are intended to be chopped down. And if they're managed properly, it serves a function. And that's okay. But sometimes, even in those instances, people don't plan properly. You know, it's been said that sometimes the worst forest fires take place in the forests that are planted for lumber because they shouldn't be planted so closely one to the other. They do it because the more it get more trees. But there needs to be more space, and that cuts down on the on the heat that builds up in these places.
Yeah.
And that's in addition to the whole concept of the climate change that, you know, exacerbates the situation. So, I mean, a responsible forest for trees that are intended for lumber is fine. Okay, because while they're alive, they're doing their thing as trees in terms of absorbing, you know, what they're absorbing things in the atmosphere, giving up oxygen, whatever they do, right? It's good. And that's fine. But if you're not careful, you generate stuff. Anyway, so the righteous person should be, hopefully, one who appreciates the good, which is the message here, right? Appreciate the good, push the good. That's the central part, right? Be good, do good. That's a righteous person. And appreciate the goodness, but also fix the bad. Okay, so anyhow, so that line, three words, Rabot, Ra'ot, Tzadik. It's unbelievable how, you know, striking they are. And then, but God says, Umikulam Yatzilanu Adonai, right? And but God will save him from all of the Ra'ot. So there's hope afterwards. Okay. All right, Leon.
Which means that we are part of the Tzadikim, Yatzilenu.
I hope so. I don't know. See, the Tzadik would never say that. The irony of the whole thing is, true Tzadik, I learned this from Rabbi David Aronson, a true Tzadik would never say, I'm a Tzadik.
Which is why I was laughing at Yatzilenu.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, well, look, I mean, God will save. The first part, right, and the second part deal with more normal people. And God will save us. So if we do good, all right, Tzadik is good plus, you know. And that's why it's Ra'ot, Ra'ot, Ra'ot. What's the result? Verse 21. Shomer atzmotav, chat mehen alo nishbar. Okay. Watching over all his bones, not one of them being broken. So the tzaddik will realize that his bones are not broken. Now, that's, we can know if you read it literally, we know that's not true. Yeah, it goes to the whole question, you know, tzaddik v'ralo rasho rashabato. Right? It's bad for the evil, good for the bad. Because the righteous can have his bones broken. But what this is saying is that, and this, by the way, Psalm 44 that I mentioned is a response to this, because this is making a statement, God will protect his, he will look and see, he may have been pushed around, but his bones aren't broken, because ultimately God will protect. That's what this is saying. It's not that simple, but this is speaking in sort of that type of term. It's supposed to generate hope. And so it doesn't get into the subtleties. But that line, Rabot Ra'ot Tzadik, boy, it opens a Pandora's box. Okay. Yes, Leon.
Again, Ibn Ezra. V'hiskira tzamot ba'avur shehem mosdot aguf. And I think that's very nice, because what he's saying is maybe he will have broken bones, but the yesod of the goof, he will save the etzem, how would you say, the what is innate in man, what makes man
yeah,
a man.
Right, yes. Yeah, that's nice. And so this is a metaphor, really. So the bones is what's inside. And that means that the essence is still there. And God will help it stay there. Yeah, good. That's interesting, yeah. All right, so then I think we're going to finish this. However, verse 22, Timotet Rasha Ra'a, Besone Tzadik Yeshamu. Ra'a here, evil, is the subject, as I said. It means evil will ultimately slay the evil person. Evil will be responsible for the death of a bad person. And what thought came to my mind is a mafioso. Nobody would argue, except maybe, even I'm another mafioso, nobody would argue that somebody who's a don in the mafia, they're not good people. I mean, they're evil. They are promoters of evil. They know it. And where do they live?
On Staten Island.
Big houses, fortified, with television, guards, armed guards. Why? Are they afraid of the police?
No.
No.
Other mafioso.
Exactly. It's the Don a half mile away that they're afraid of. Right. But what happens if the Don from a half a mile away is able to buy off one of the guards of our Don and he slips some poison into the wine of Ardan, he's dead. So the evil ultimately destroyed the evil person. That's what it's saying. Basically, what it's saying is eventually it catches up with you. Now, that too is a simplistic statement. We know that. But the fact is, one can make the case that people who do a lot of evil live with that because they know that the consequences could be right around the corner. And I'm not sure, I don't know any horribly evil people. I've never really talked to a horribly evil people. Now, they may say that they're above it. Oh, no, nobody can touch me. But the fact is, see how they run their lives. Is it not possible that they are more afraid of death than we are? And that they basically live constantly with that pressure on them.
Part of the religious answer to this is that what this is talking about is, yeah, the punishment is there. We may not see it. There's the idea of Olam Haba, that it's like at some later point, yes, or that it's some torment here, but it's a faith. It's a faith that good will out and the world is not just whoever's more powerful wins.
Yes.
I don't think that's provable one way or the other, quite frankly.
No, it's not. It's faith.
Except as far as I've heard, Hitler's not alive.
Yeah.
And he's not having a good time.
No, it's
Hitler's what?
Not alive.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
I'm saying, you know,
neither are the 6 million he killed.
Yeah. No, I know. This is, and part of, I think, what, and I'm not sure, I think Christianity may do a better job of helping people adjust to it than Judaism does, whether it's based on, quote, truth or not. But it's tough to see the righteous suffering and the innocent die and suffer. You know, children get cancer. I mean, right. maybe that's the original meaning of that God, that God makes, you know, good and evil.
Yeah, well, it is.
I don't know.
But I would just like to comment on one thing you just said, that the Christians do a better job.
Maybe they do.
I would say that maybe the reason is in our communities, let me put it to you this way. A Haredi Jew would not have the same questions that we have.
Right, okay.
Not that they won't ask questions, but they'll find the answer. They'll grab onto the solutions more quickly. The problem in our communities are that we're not that pious. Our faith, too many of our people are not really people of faith. They do Jewish things because they find it meaningful, and that's good. But the concept of a God that's behind it all is very distant from them.
Right.
And so that may be. And then the United States, by the way, is a very religious country. From what I understand, from all of the Western-oriented countries, we're the most religious one. The European countries are very secularized. And, you know, many of the...
You mean observant when you say religious or spiritual?
I'm talking about faith in God and having it be a factor in your life.
Not you should see it here in Samoa.
Wait.
There's so many churches. They're not all big churches in Samoa. But they're small churches. But when I talked to the guide that we had, it was really rather interesting because in their villages, they have chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
The chief decides you can't go swimming on a Sunday. Yes. I guess for the same reason that some Orthodox Jews feel you can't go swimming because drying yourself off with a towel is work. Although if you went into the swimming pool and didn't dry yourself off and let the sun do it, it really isn't work, right? But it's amazing. I mean, there's a sign on the ocean.
That's the same thing as a Rebbe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's no different. Okay, Leon, I think we got to end. But go ahead, Leon, final.
Well, I was simply going to
say, have we finished the thing?
I have not found a single very religious and observant personage in the book of Genesis, or, you know, which are supposed to have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. None of these people.
But I think, well, you're right. I mean, the stories there are more intended to deal with God's, you know, sort of laying it lays the foundation between the relationship between God and people.
But he also, part of that relationship is, to me, the most beautiful part of the Bible, Abraham, saying, Hashopet kol ha'aretz lo yase mishpat.
Right. Yes.
We challenge God, and I think that...
That's okay.
That's okay, yeah.
God doesn't, you know, a pious Jew would say, that's fine. God wants that. But you're standing in a relationship with them.
Yes.
All right, Tybel.
I just want to remind you, you said we were going to have a decision, which I'm presuming is about continuing past the original
right. Yes.
Nine.
Yes. No. Or I'm going to end. Oh, I've got one more verse. Time out. Last line. The very last line. And this is the final piece of the Kayas.
Oh, no.
It's a very troubling for me, very troubling statement. God redeems the soul of his servants. In other words, us, people who are believers, the tzaddikim, the yirei Hashem, the ones that seek God. And none who take refuge in him will be condemned. Whoop-de-doo. Why doesn't it add Pode Aron Nefesh Avadav? Adonai Hoshia Ya'anenu B'yom
Kareinu.
Why isn't it God will redeem the souls of his servants? God will redeem. He will answer us when we call, the day we call. Why doesn't it say that? It says we're not going to be held guilty. That's very disappointing. Maybe the guy ran out of steam. I mean, you know, he's got the reference. He's completed his chiasm here because there's the tzaddik. No, I'm sorry. No. The last line. Wait a minute. We missed it. No, we didn't. Yeah, sonei tzaddik. I didn't do the sorry. Sonei tzaddik yeshamu. The people who hate the righteous. That's the ending of the chiasm. I'm sorry. Verse 22. That's the end, because the chiasm is 2 through 22. Okay. So, Neit Tzadik Yeshamu, those who hate the righteous, they will be found condemned. Okay. And now, but I think the reason why it says Belo Yeshmu Kol HaChosim Bo in 23 is because it connects. The verb Aleph Sheen Mem is in the previous line, and it sort of connects it in. But that's the one. I like the first half. God will redeem the soul of those who serve him. That's terrific.
Period.
But then, yeah, even then, period. He won't be found guilty. That means I don't need vidui when I die. I don't know. What does it mean? Rick.
Hi. Well, the verse 22 was the tough verse. That was the end of the alphabet, but it ends on such a bad word, yeshamu, condemned. So somebody came along and said, well, no, you can't end the psalm that way. Do something more positive. So they threw in another sentence with the yeshamu and ending kol hachosim bo instead.
In other words, to take that notion and sort of turn it around and say, there may be guilt here, but the righteous won't get it.
Maybe. I don't know.
It could be.
It could have ended on the tough, right? That's the alphabetical ending.
Yeah.
But somebody didn't like it ending that way.
Yeah, it could be. So. Or, in other words, the author didn't put it in himself. Somebody else stuck it in.
Maybe one of his students. Well, you know, you don't want to end an aliyah. You don't end the Haftorah on a sour note. They repeat the sentence before, or they do something different.
I understand that. Yes. But the point is, though, that this ends up basically in not a sour note, But it's that thing, they won't be found guilty.
Again, this generalizes what is a Hasid, what is a Tzaddik, because not just Tzaddikim ask for shelter of the Lord.
Right.
And that reminds us of what we had before, where we had the same situation.
Yes.
Which again, he spread it.
I see what you're doing. So this is a taking of the, I got it. It's Okay. That's good. So he's bringing us back to the broader picture.
Correct.
Saying that it's not only because he talked about the brokenhearted.
Correct.
Or, which we presume was a tzaddik because it was in the context of a discussion about tzaddikim.
Correct.
But here he's taking it and applying it to a broader picture once again. Because
it's the avadav.
Those who are servants of God. Yes. And they will not meet the same fate.
Correct.
Of the evil one. Okay, that's good. Thank you. Now I can sleep.
Beautiful.
All right.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. Now, so this is the question. Tonight was supposed to be our last session. I am prepared to study with you Psalm 49, which is the psalm that we say in the house of mourning. Mm-hmm. It's there's a line in there that is the Hebrew equivalent. You'll see if we do study it. The line, you know, you've never seen a Brinks truck following a hearse. You don't see a Brinks truck following a hearse, meaning you can't take it with you. Okay. That is one of the messages of Psalm 49. It's really interesting. But the thing packs a wallop. Because it makes some statements about even seemingly people who do the right thing that are really not so faithful. And that's why I want to read it, because it's strange, because it's not a very, on the surface, a very comforting psalm. I don't find it comforting. I think it's practical. It has a pragmatic tone to it. And maybe that's something you need. I once taught this at a Dvar Torah in a Shiva home, and I raised this issue. And it may be that the whole notion that we talk about, Hamakom Yenachem Etchem, right, that line that we say, God comfort you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. And that's the theme that we develop in order to comfort. And we are present. We talk a lot about comforting. But the psalm reminds us of the finality of death. And the person who mentioned this said it may be important that not be lost. Same reason why it's important to bury the dead and to have the family members put in the first shovels. Because it helps them understand the finality of death. When you hear the soil thumping or smashing, not smashing, but pounding against, whether it's a vault inside or whether it's the casket itself, when you hear it hitting, you know, it tells you that this is real. This person's not going to come back physically. And there's a hole in our lives. Okay? And it's important that not be forgotten.
And so, is your question whether we would want to come to that class?
Well, the question is, do we want that? It could take another couple of weeks.
So
I'm certainly yes. up for it.
The answer is yes.
Yes.
Answered yes for me. Count me in.
Yes.
Marlies, you guys?
I don't know if I can come because of where I'll be, but if I'm available, I want to be there.
All right.
Well, we're recorded for you.
We'll record it. Barbara, that's Samoa. That's a beach in Samoa.
So we have the same problem. If you're taping it, so yes, I would like you to do it because I can listen to the tapes.
We do it all. We do it every week. It's on the TV. So
in a few weeks, Gary and I will be away at the same trip. Yeah, but
let's keep on going. Rabbi Rembaum, you spent the time.
You're not going to be away until the 24th of March.
Right.
That's 2 weeks from now.
Two and a half. Yeah.
I will make an announcement that we're going to extend this class 2 more weeks.
Wonderful.
Again, I'll be on a boat.
I'm not going to be able to join you in person.
Wait. Hold on. One at a time. All right. Leon.
I'll be on a boat in 2 weeks, but I think I'll be able to attend.
Okay.
You're going to the Mexican Riviera.
Oh, how nice.
We're in New Zealand in 2 weeks, and I think that I have a tour that day and the week after in Australia. So I think I can't, but I'm going to be listening, so I want you to do it.
If I forget, Bert will remind me to turn on.
Oh, right. Absolutely, yeah.
All right, so I will call the shul and tomorrow and tell them please make an announcement that Rabbi Rembaum Samsas will be continued for 2 more weeks.
So. Oh, great. Great. I love you.
Great. Good news.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am, Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.